Hey, happy people. Thanks for checking in. My name's John with the Sync Center, and we are deep into a series called the Sync Supervision and Clearance Series, where we talk about questions and best practices for managing music in visual media, whether it's an advertising campaign, a theatrical release, branded content on YouTube, or even a first-time filmmaker in film festivals. Managing music can be tricky, so we like to set aside some time to unpack and talk about a common question, really to help you succeed in getting your project out in the world. Welcome, everybody, to the Sync Supervision and Clearance Podcast. My name's John, and I've got a real special guest with us today. He's a recent friend of mine. He lives in Lisbon. His name's Paulo Leite, and he's a filmmaker, horror fan, music fan, and he's written a book that I recently became aware of, and it's really interesting. It's called Music Licensing for Films and Games, What a Producer Should Know. So we're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about his approach from the filmmaker standpoint, what filmmakers, maybe what their blind spots are, and kind of how to go about managing the music process as a filmmaker. So, Paulo, say hello, my friend.
Well, hello, hello. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Hey, glad to have you on and talk about the book, talk about what you're doing. I think it'll be really interesting as more and more projects are being done in more and more mediums, streaming, AT&T, Roku. There's just more and more music being used in more and more projects. So that's part of our mission at the Sync Center, is to really help filmmakers, advertisers, YouTube, in kind of understanding the ground game, right? We just want to help them understand the blocking and tackling of the process. So let's see, quick bit about Paulo. He was born in Brazil, lived in Lisbon for 20 years, started working in TV at the age of 17 as an assistant director, went to film production and screenwriting school. I almost said screenwriting. That may be a horror bit that we could talk about later. Worked as an assistant producer, production manager, line producer, and a bunch of other jobs in the film industry. He's sold scripts. He's worked with producers. And then from there, he started teaching film development, marketing, and financing in Lisbon. Is that, Paulo?
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He's directed horror films. He's a big horror fan. He's a music fan. He loves vinyl. And he has a handful of other horror projects in development. So with that, Paulo, welcome to the Sync Center podcast.
Thank you very much.
That's a lot of stuff you've done in your brief number of years. How did you get there?
Well, I always had, first of all, I always had lots of love for films. So when I finished high school, the first thing I said to myself is, I want to work in this. So I did, back then, I did a very short course that was available to me back then. And immediately I started, I sent a resume with basically half a page to a TV studio. And they said, okay, we'll take you. They were also starting out. So I spent something like 4 or 5 years there.
And this is in Brazil or Lisbon?
No, it was already in Lisbon. Okay. And then from then on, I hated the work that I did on television. The shows were so boring, absolutely boring. And then I decided, okay, if I want to work on films, I will never be able to do this if I remain here. So I left that career on TV and I went to film school. So I studied film and I loved it. And after that, I started working on films and I never stopped. Mm-hmm. So I started as assistant producer, you know, driving cars and doing all those things.
Right, right.
And I started, one thing led to another. And then I started to switch to financing and helping other filmmakers, which I love to do.
Right, right.
And here I am.
That's great. So you've seen a lot of moving parts of the film and music world as it relates to film. What were you drawn to? Now you're kind of developing and doing financing. You kind of saw a lot of moving parts of it. Did you kind of learn quickly of where you wanted to be, where you didn't want to be?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I always wanted to kind of write stories and work in horror movies. I only managed to do this a few years ago.
Which we're going to talk about horror movies. Let's set aside some time for that.
Awesome.
I'm a big fan too.
Well, marry me. So one thing led to another. So in this business, you have to learn things very fast because everything changes very fast. So when I started working, everything was film, you know, film stock. And then digital revolution came, took everybody by surprise. So like you said in the beginning, I mean, lots of things that are happening today, people were not thinking about them 10 years ago or 15 years ago. So I became very sensitive to these issues of financing, licensing. As soon as I started developing my own projects, as soon as I started developing scripts and helping other people write and selling a few scripts here and a few stories there, I started noticing that those issues were very real. And they don't have to do just with the producer, you know. More and more filmmakers have to do a little bit of everything.
Right.
And you have to know a little bit of everything. And also, because films today, because there's digital, right?
Everything's democratized. Everybody's a
filmmaker. Everything's very democratized. Yeah. It's a lot cheaper to shoot a film.
Right.
Not necessarily to deliver a film. Delivering a film that is technically perfect still costs a lot of money, especially on post. In sound post is still very complex.
Right.
But today, at least shooting a film is significantly cheaper than it was 25 years ago. So a lot of people are entering the business and making films, and they are not necessarily thinking about those issues that can break your film if you don't think of them early enough.
Yeah.
So that's how I got the idea for the film. Actually, for the book. The book started as a kind of a paper that I did for my students. Started evolving from then. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. It's called Music Licensing for Films and Games: What a Producer Should Know. And I've got the first half of it here as a pre-release. So you said it kind of came about as a paper for your students originally.
Yeah. I started summing it up a little bit of the questions that I myself had when I started. And then after years of working with other producers and working with filmmakers and trying to ask questions and answer questions, you know, you're forced to ask people. And then see a lot of mistakes happening. And I made a lot of mistakes, and I saw people make lots of mistakes. For example, I have a dear friend who made a film, and he wanted a very, very, very famous band. And because the film was set in the 70s, and he wanted to for that music to be on the script and to be discussed on the script.
Right.
And it was clear to me that, okay, you're going to play the music on the movie, right? And he said, of course. And I said, well, if it's that important to the film, if the characters are going to talk about it, they're going to talk about the lyrics and they're going to listen to the music, you have to clear it before. You have to get a yes before you start shooting. Otherwise, you may end up in the post-production and either it's too expensive or it's simply not available.
Yeah, we get that all the time. Filmmakers, I mean, I'm not notorious, but they wait for music until the end of the film. And by then, you know, getting the music you want isn't a fast process. We move fast, but there's a lot of stakeholders involved, a lot of rights holders, and you know, it just takes time. You know, unless you're Microsoft, and we do a bunch of stuff for them, but they just don't care. They're like, it doesn't matter. Just, you know, we'll pay whatever needs paid, you know. But filmmakers are a little more cost sensitive. You know, they don't have unlimited budgets.
That is true. And also because of that, you have to explain very carefully what you're doing, what you want to do with the scene. Explain very carefully because it's the relationship. Like I said, I mean, I know a bunch of people who tried to do this fast and cheap and perfectly, and it's impossible. Mm-hmm. So when you get to the post-production, you lock the music and you have already a delivery date with your sales agent and distributor is waiting for it.
Sure.
And then you wait for the music to get there. And it's not the most efficient and effective way to work. Unfortunately, and that's also true, creation takes time. And it is also true that many directors cannot imagine yet the music they're going to want for the scene. So it's always a tension between the creative necessities, the creative needs, and the process itself. So it will never be perfect, okay?
Yeah.
But filmmakers should understand what's involved, and perhaps learn with other people's mistakes and try to do better.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's why I got the book, because I think I'm a filmmaker too. So this is a talk from filmmakers to filmmakers, you know?
Yeah, that's great. That's super, super important and super needed, because we have people every day that call us frustrated, you know, whether it's supervision, clearance, or music replacement, we'll call it. You know, they're hitting their head up against their table, trying to do the right thing.
Yep.
They don't know who to talk to. They can't get an email return because they're, you know, submitting on some page and it's a black hole of nothingness. Starting early is huge. And it also saves time, you know, because when you start early, you can kind of allocate your budget accordingly. Like if you need those super songs, you can allocate and kind of pre-price those and say, okay, these are going to cost X amount each. Yeah. Okay, so maybe we don't need the mid-tier song. Maybe we can do some music replacement on those.
Of course. That
mid-tier stuff. And you spend money where you need it, right? If you need the super songs, get the super songs. But be smart about your music spend. And a lot of filmmakers think it's, you know, if you don't do this every day, you think it's like ordering from a Chinese menu. Just click the box, yeah, that, done, let's go. And it's not quite that easy. Yeah. So let's talk about the book here. How long have you been working on this, Paula?
I worked in it for almost a year. So I started the text of the mm-hmm. of all the themes of that I exploit that I explored. Then I finished the Q&A, because I said, well, there's so much stuff that people ask. Why don't I just put the questions in the Q&A section? And I'll answer them. You know, let's pretend that people are asking me. Let's pretend that it's a filmmaker who asked, okay, if I want to use The Girl from Ipanema, why do I have to pay Norman Gimbel? You know, he isn't the composer. And I said, no, he did translate the lyrics. So if you check, so there are lots of these questions that people usually ask out of the blue. They come and they say, oh my God, do I have to pay for this? Or do I have to ask that person?
Yeah.
And sometimes, yeah, you do. And I try to explain why. So I try to explain why these things happen the way they do.
Yeah.
Because like you said, people are not sensitive to the time issue, to the pressing of the time.
And they don't know what they don't know, right? If they don't do this every day, you don't know. It took us half a dozen attempts back in the early 90s of just imploding to where we kind of figured it out 20 years ago. And now we've, you know, kind of got it down to a science. So this is from the book, Music Licensing for Films and Video Games, What a Producer Should Know. is a book that helps film, TV, video game producers to understand the complexities of getting the songs they want into their films, TV series, and video games. The book explains in easy and plain English who you should talk to and what information you should have in order to go through the licensing process. Also, the book comes with a Q&A series that covers many common scenarios and an analysis of the song list of several famous Hollywood films. So that's from the book itself. So So let me ask you a question. Something that came out to me in just perusing the book: diegetic and non-diegetic music. We've been doing this for 20 years, and we've never heard of that. What is diegetic?
This is screenplay people talking.
Okay.
This is how we deal with narrative music and narrative. You know, the word diegetic comes from Greek. So the idea is diegetic music is, very simply put, the music that comes from the story, you know, like when the character turns on the radio, when you hear someone dancing, they go into the disco, or someone answers the phone and right. It's a ringtone, it's the elevator music, you know, like the Blues Brothers, right. When they go into the elevator at the end. Mm-hmm. And it's playing
Muzak.
This is diegetic music. It comes from inside the narrative. The characters can hear it.
Okay.
And then you have non.
So there's a physical. Music. There's a like it's happening to them.
Yeah.
Real time.
Yeah. Okay. They can hear it.
Yeah.
So non diegetic music, it comes from outside the story, from outside the narrative. The most famous scene in Hitchcock's Psycho, when Marion Crane gets killed in the shower, and mm-hmm. you hear Bernard Herrmann's amazing classic soundtrack, she's not hearing any of that.
Right.
So only the audience can hear that.
Gotcha.
So that comes from outside the story. That's why we call it non-diegetic music.
Gotcha.
And it plays when you murder someone. During a chase scene, you know, that stringent, fast-paced music that you hear, usually mm-hmm. orchestral music, yep. sometimes pre-existing music, whatever. But it comes from outside the story.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, that's great. So what, you mentioned something in the first or second chapter of the book, E&O Insurance. And it has to do with chain of title. What is that? How does that come into play?
Well, if you're working with films that cost a certain amount of money upwards, like let's say $1 million, $2 million, it is very possible, and I think it will be guaranteed, that either your financiers or your distributors mm-hmm. Will demand that you have errors and omissions insurance, which I think is a very good idea. You know, errors and omissions, this is the type of insurance that will free the producer from any responsibility that comes from infringement of rights, mistakes right, okay. made during the production on that level. And
yeah.
what will happen usually is that you show the film to the insurer, they will yep. take a look at the film, they will see every instance where there are rights in intellectual property rights involved,
right,
and they will ask for all the documentation yep. that testify that makes sure that everything was taken care of, and right. after they are happy with it, they will insure the film, and only after that, if any claim comes and anybody says, oh, I wasn't paid for this, or my right is there, etc., and then the insurance covers.
Right.
So that's why it is so important for the filmmaker to have the music rights perfectly written.
That's interesting, because we've been a part of that a handful of times, kind of on the other end, on the supervision and clearance side of it. And as they were turning it, we were working on a film for Showtime or HBO, and they were very rigorous. The filmmaker was turning in the film, and Showtime had a very rigorous okay, do we have this? Do we have this? Do we have this? Do we have this? And so, yeah. You know, at the end of that project, we had, I don't know, 15, 20 different pieces of music. And you know, we delivered them a stack of, okay, here's your licenses. Here's your total, what you spent. You know, your everything is 100% in line.
They want to check everything, and they must check everything, because they do not want any liability running around. You know, especially if you think that in movies, this is very important, because let's say that you have a film, you put a lot of money on your film, you worked hard for the film, and you hope the film is going to be a success. You hope you're going to find a good distributor to take it to movie theaters. Listen, no distributor will start spending money on promoting your film just to receive a court order, because some composer somewhere is disgruntled and he wants everything to stop. Yep. So it's fundamental to have those things, and especially big companies like HBO, Warner Brothers, Paramount Pictures, Netflix, they have deep pockets. So when they get sued, believe me, it can hurt. Yeah. So, and always the filmmaker is the one that ends up hurting, because his film didn't get chosen because they got passed because the paper wasn't in order. And then they have to come back and take time to do it. It can be it can be a nightmare.
Right.
So well, that's why everything should be rightly on paper and on time.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. And something that we rub up against is filmmakers often want in perp licenses in perpetuity, which means forever. Like we want to use it however.
Which and is expensive.
Very expensive. And a lot of times when we bring back the budgets for that, they're like, well, we can't afford in perp, but we can afford 5 years or an annual license. I mean, how do you explain that to a filmmaker that, you know, he's going to have to come back, you know, every 5 years and upgrade their license? I mean, it's not a perfect solution, but if you want to get it out there for 5 years, you just pay for the first 5 years.
They have a fit, and I understand. But the thing is, most of the films, and this is where we filmmakers, sometimes we have to sit down and think carefully, you know, and think with the brains and not with the heart. Of course, we love our films. Of course, we love our babies.
Yeah.
But the real question here is, okay, if you want perpetuity on everything, you won't afford what you would like to have. So you're going to have to go to stuff that's very cheap and maybe not the best.
Yeah.
So here's what I think. If you can afford 5 years, go for 5 years, make the best film you can, put the best music you can afford, obviously. Make sure the music works for the film. Make sure it works for the scene. Right. Deliver the best effect that you can. Hopefully, your film is going to be a success and people will understand the love, the quality of the choices, the musical choices that you made.
Right.
And probably in 5 years, the new licensing you're going to have to do probably will not be that hard to do, because, okay, the film has some following. It did make some money. There are distributors interested in renewing the licensing for distribution. And okay, but you did try to do the best film and you got the best music for the first Windows release.
Yeah.
And that can be very, very, very important. 5 years from now, let's see.
You'll know in 5 years.
You know? Yeah, worst case scenario. On the worst case scenario, okay, you did an art house film that didn't really resonate with the audience, did a few festivals, didn't win any award. You know, distributors didn't really like it, or it made very little money. If that's the case, if that's the worst case scenario, you know that in 5 years, probably your film will not be renewed anyway.
You saved a lot of money by not.
And you saved a lot of money. And you still had a film that you were proud of when you first made it.
Yeah.
So people really have they have a fit when you say, okay, we cannot get perpetuity. But it's music and it's really expensive. And I cannot dictate the price. You know, it's not on me.
Yeah.
It's not on us. Unfortunately, we would love it to be, but it isn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I when we talk to filmmakers and advertisements and branded content, it's like, it's a question of, is it a short game or is it a long game? Like if you're doing a film festival, just get it into the world over the next
year. Absolutely.
And that's a short game. Do that thing. But if you're looking at a 5, 10, 20 year strategy, it's like, then pay for what you need. We do in perp all the time. We can get it for you. It's just, you know, it's going to be painful to the pocketbook.
Well, Hollywood movies, of course, Hollywood movies get perpetuity because they know they're going to be around for a long time. Right. You have George Clooney, Meryl Streep, Kate Blanchett. Of course, in 10 years, the film is going to be here. Of course, in 20 years, it's going to be here. But for independent filmmakers, most of the films are not here in 5 years or 10 years.
Right.
A lot of television isn't, right? So, yeah. In fact, it's interesting that only with DVD that we started seeing so many TV shows circulating in home video.
Right.
25 years ago, during the VHS time, we didn't have multiple seasons of whatever show available, you know?
Right.
So this was something, this was a kind of a small revolution that also, and tons of producers back then had to renew all the licenses because they had to now relicense everything for disc. They put on their contracts cassettes, and suddenly DVDs are not cassettes. So the rights holders say, well, renew it again.
Yep.
So 5 years from now, if your film is a hit, even if it's a modest success, probably will not have too much trouble getting the means to renew it. Mm-hmm. But make sure that you have the best scenes and the best music for it, and it works.
Right, right. We ran into a situation similar to that, Paulo. Gosh, I think one of the earliest syncs we did for our catalog was back when Dawson's Creek was coming out, like mid-90s. And we licensed some songs for that. And then when it went to Netflix, you know, this was, you know, 13 years later, 14 years later, you know, Netflix didn't exist. So there was no streaming for any of that usage, like you said, in the DVD.
Nobody saw it coming.
So now Dawson's Creek had to go back and resync every episode for streaming. And if they used a Britney Spears song in 19, whenever, you know, well, now that song's not available at that price, you know, and it's kind of cost prohibitive. So we ended up replacing a lot of music, like the music in the streaming Dawson's Creek is different from the network and DVD.
Well, that happens a lot.
Yeah.
One of my favorite zombie films, you know, Return of the Living Dead. Mm. They had a couple of songs also changed for DVD. I mean,
right.
I had the VHS version that came up in the late 80s.
Yeah.
You see the DVD version. They changed it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because either it becomes unavailable or it becomes too expensive. Which happens, you know,
right.
And classic shows, some shows are quite more difficult than others, I'm sure. I'm a child from the 80s, so I remember Moonlighting with Bruce Willis. They used to have Moonlighting had a great soundtrack of old Motown songs. You used to see there Sam Cooke. You used to hear Diane the Supremes a few times. Yeah, yeah. You know,
all
you
the old Motown. Motown,
Marvin Gaye, I think.
Yeah.
Percy Sledge. You had several great artists. I always said to myself, when I bought the DVDs years ago, I said to myself, boy, this must have cost a fortune to relicense for DVD. And many shows did take some time to get everything done.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
That's awesome. Return of the Living Dead. Interesting choice.
Yep. I love the film.
Okay.
Actually, I do, it's on the book. So I saw that in there. I select a few of the films that I like.
Yeah. I'm a big Night of the Living Dead. The original 68 George Romero is, to me, even outside of the genre, we can go down the horror zombie rabbit hole here for a minute. Even outside of horror films and zombie subgenres. It's a great film. I mean, it's ahead of its time in a dozen different ways, let alone terrifying and awesome on a horror level. But to have a African-American lead in 1968, it's great.
That was courageous. That is true.
Oh,
that is true. The film is incredible. It is so, good horror films, they usually are, they are revolutionary. They offend, you know. They do all these kinds of things that other genres can't do. Uh-huh. And Night of the Living Dead is one of those films. I'm sure I wasn't born there.
I wasn't either.
But I can imagine the shock, the shock people felt, you know.
The last 5 minutes of that movie, when they cut to, I mean, it's all in black and white, but they cut to like a newsreel section where, you know, whatever brought the zombies to life is now gone, and they're going out there and they're just taking them down. And you know, the last survivor in the house is, what was his name? The African-American lead for Night of the Living Dead. I forget his name, but he made it, right? He lived. Horrible night. Everybody else died. Bad night for humans. Good night for zombies. And he looks out the window and the sheriff's deputies shoot him in the head and they burn him thinking he was a zombie. I mean, it's just unbelievable ending on a film level. I mean, most films kind of leave you with that feel good ending, and it's like, oh, they shot him right as he, you know, as it was, you know. So anyway, that's a great big George Romero fan. So awesome.
No, I got all his movies signed in a film festival. I met him at a film festival years ago. Huh. And I took all my DVDs and VHS tapes and I put them on the table, and he was very kind. He was very nice, very generous. And he signed them all for me. I treasure it forever.
Fortunate for him to be at a director screening of Land of the Dead, which wasn't a fantastic movie. Or maybe it was the one after that. It was the Diary of the Dead, something like that. And it was, you know, it was great just to hear him tell the stories and talk about a legal issue that kind of stuck in his side from the get-go. He never, you know, had the appropriate copyright around the original Night of the Living Dead. True. Which is, you know, partially, I guess, why it became so omnipresent, because there was no copyright on the film and anybody could show it at, you know, midnight showing of whatever, and it just became, you know, everywhere. So that's great. George Romero, I'm glad to meet another zombie brother. So you talk about I Will Always Love You. Let's flip back from zombies into Dolly Parton.
Okay.
And Whitney Houston. You, there's a case study in the book where you talk about I Will Always Love You from 1974. Can you step us through that and kind of talk about how that?
Well, what I describe in the book is the differences that many times we have to understand between the composition and the recording. And that's where I give the example of I Will Always Love You. So it's a song by Dolly Parton. It's a breakthrough song in her career. Everybody loves the song. Everybody knows the song. And then we have to understand that one thing is the composer and one thing is the recording or the master of that composition. So what I discuss in the film is, okay, you have the song that you want. So as a filmmaker, you have always to break that song into parts. So you have the publishing of the composer, mm-hmm. and then you have the master recording that probably will belong to a record label or maybe the artist herself. It depends. And you will have always to ask both parties if you want to use that master of that composition. Right. Whitney Houston has the second version, or one of the many versions I think the song has, that is featured on her film, The Bodyguard. Right. And the same thing also happens with that other song from I'm Every Woman from Ashford mm-hmm. Simpson.
Right.
Ashford and Simpson. And also you have the Chaka Khan version, and also you have the Whitney Houston version. So you have to select for the film you're making. You have to understand, okay, which version of the song do I want?
Right.
So do I want the version by Dolly Parton? Do I want I Will Always Love You by Dolly, or do I want the version with Whitney? So right. You will be asking different people for different masters, mm-hmm. but you always have to go back to the composer for those rights.
Right.
So it's sometimes filmmakers like sometimes we think it's all the same, or sometimes we think that because you're paying the composition, you can use any master you want. So obviously mm-hmm. that's not the case. So you always have to be very careful.
Right.
Select the song exactly which version of the song you want, mm-hmm. which master do you want? Do you want the long version, the short version? Do you want the version with, you know, you have to be very careful. Look at the CD, buy the CD if possible. You know, the information usually mm-hmm. is there.
Yeah.
That's where you're gonna find the copyright there. Usually, sometimes you find the catalog number. Sometimes you find the publisher is there identified, and then you start calling people and looking for what you want and trying to get it. I mean, right. It's going to take time, it's going to cost some money, but you have to do it.
Yeah. Yep. 100%. Yeah, that circle C and circle P, handling both sides of the copyright is essential for this. So,
and sometimes it gets weird. For example, going for the holy grail of holy grails, like the Beatles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have the master, you have the remaster. You have to understand exactly what you're looking for. Some songs, for example, they have changed over time. Some of them, they come in different shapes and forms, and it is always up to the filmmaker to understand exactly what he wants, or he or she.
Yeah.
Because the record label, they don't know. I mean, I've seen people, and it's funny. Sometimes you see people saying, this wasn't the song that I wanted. And I say, no, that's what you asked for. And they say, no, I wanted the other version. I wanted the other song. And sometimes you have to be careful.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And that's something we've been doing, Paula. We've been doing a lot of re-records. So we would license The Boys Are Back in Town from Thin Lizzy. And those prices have gone up over the last 10 years or so. So we, in order, you know, in working with our clients, you know, we've gone in and recreated some of those super songs, you know, American Woman, you know, Ain't No Mountain High Enough, Magic from the Cars. And then we give them the option of saying, okay, look, we can get the Thin Lizzy version for 200 plus. And it's usually the labels that are most precious with them, as they should be. Publishers are generally pretty reasonable. But, you know, we can get the Thin Lizzy version, or we can, you know, pay a fifth for the re-record and spend that money elsewhere, you know. And it's, the re-records are 92% of the way there. They're pretty damn good, but nobody's going to reproduce Thin Lizzy and Phil Lynott. I mean, it's not going to happen. But at least it gives the filmmaker options of saying, look, do you want the most expensive 250K song, or do you want something for 30K? We can do both. It's just kind of it's a director decision at that point.
This is a fascinating conversation to have with filmmakers. And also sometimes difficult because, for example, The Doors, they are notoriously hard to get and expensive when you can get it. And there are many case studies around it. For example, in that film, The Lost Boys, mm-hmm. In the in the beginning, in the title sequence, they play "People Are Strange." Yeah. But of course, they couldn't get the original Doors version, so they found a different band. In this case, was Echo and the Bunnymen, to re-record it. It's actually, of course, it's not the Doors. Probably, of course, the director probably wanted the Doors.
Sure.
But the re-recording is not bad. It also has its own life, you know.
Yeah.
There are many instances where the re-recording is absolutely fine. And yes, you will not necessarily lose flavor or anything by not using the original version.
Right.
There are, unless your audience is really, really, really picky, and that's a conversation you have to have with the director, you know, many of the times you really don't need Thin Lizzy, the real studio master. And you said it correctly. The studios are, the record labels are always very careful, because those are the masters of our lives. You know, we grew up with those songs. Those are the songs that stuck in our minds. And the record labels know that. Record rights holders know these things. That's why they are very expensive. They make themselves pay for that.
Yeah.
They make themselves get the money for that. So so you're right. I mean, many times you ask, well, do I really need Thin Lizzy? And also you ask, but how long are you going to play the song? And what's happening in the song? Maybe there is also noise. Maybe you don't need the real master, the original studio master. You can re-record it. There are many artists, especially those one-hit wonders from the 60s and 70s, who after 20 years of the contract, they now can re-record those songs, because many record labels, they forbid
Taylor the Swift
to do it. Yep. Exactly. And 20 years or 30 years later, you find a re-recorded version of the song, and it will not be exactly the original one,
right,
but maybe your half 90% of your audience won't notice the difference.
You have to weigh the cost benefit. Like,
exactly,
if you need everything, the original, you get the original. But if it's 90% there, maybe that's worth 150K. Exactly.
So, everything, you know, boils down to this thing of it's cost versus benefit.
Right.
Most of the time, you know the cost. So it's up to the filmmaker to rob a bank and see if he really wants the Beatles.
A good friend of ours, tying into that, Paulo, when the pilot for True Blood was being made, they temped in a Johnny Cash song. And, you know, the creator of it kind of wrote to that Johnny Cash song and really fell in love with it. And Johnny Cash wasn't available. True Blood, they didn't know if it was going to be a hit or whatever. And so a good friend of ours, Jace Everett, who wrote a song called Bad Things, we switched out the Johnny Cash for the Jace Everett song. And, you know, for Jace, that song was the theme to True Blood for, I don't know, 8 seasons. And it, you know, bought him a house, bought him some cars, you know, it was a really good thing for Jace. And nobody mentioned Johnny Cash. I mean, the Jace Everett song became synonymous with True Blood. And, you know, it's, you know, oftentimes, like you said about the Doors, it's like, well, you may want the Doors, but, you know, it's the re-record or a song replacement, music replacement is oftentimes a much smarter use.
Yesterday I was watching again The Lost Boys, and Tim Campello's version of I Still Believe from the fall. That's a classic scene of the film, you know. I mean,
right,
sometimes you can use the re-recording to your advantage.
Definitely.
Because you can create something that is equally relevant in the terms of the context of the scene.
Yeah.
It will not be the original, but to be honest, nobody will be asking for the original. Once they see the scene and how good the song works in the film, there isn't really a necessity, unless, of course, if you really want to date the scene and you really want the music to do the dating of the scene, okay, go for it.
Yeah.
In the beginning of, I think it's in the beginning of The Conjuring 2, I think, they opened one sequence with The Clash, I think London Calling.
Okay.
And of course, yeah, okay, it's 1978, you know, and okay, if you want to date right. the song, if you want to date the yeah. scene and make sure people understand that's the 70s,
time
okay,
stamp.
Look for a song. Exactly.
Yeah.
But also, yeah. if you're in the 70s and you cannot pay for, I know, The Clash or I don't know, Donna Summer, if you cannot pay for those, you also have options. I mean,
yeah.
besides re-recording, you can also look for a similar song from that era that also right. had the taste from the 70s and still work in the film. So
mm-hmm.
you always have options. It is
yeah,
very 100%. Rare that you, if it's done with time, if you devote some time to think about these things carefully before you get pressed by the post-production,
yeah,
you always have options. It's very yeah. rare when you will not have an option. It's
mm-hmm. yeah.
And by the way, great. People like you guys, I mean, you guys have enough experience, I'm sure, to come up with options that we filmmakers haven't even thought of
all the time. It's
that's why music supervisors, people who work yeah. Music like you guys, that's why you guys are so important.
Yeah, it's not monolithic anymore. It's like, it used to be you're either a clearance agent or a music supervisor.
Yep.
Now it's like we manage the music budget, you know, for replacement, re-records, scoring composers, clearance, supervision, all that. You can't separate that out and succeed. Yep. You really have to have an integrated, holistic conversation about all that. Because
yeah.
this affects this, and this affects this, and it's all, you know.
Yeah,
it,
yeah because producers, in on my side, producers, if you say to a producer, okay, let's recreate a certain sound, I wouldn't know how to do it. So that's not my business.
Yeah.
You know, I can make the film, but
sure.
don't ask me to come up with that solution because I don't know the musicians.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't know music. So if I say to you, yeah. okay, let's get some, I don't know, let's get some Curtis Mayfield sound, or let's re-record something that sounds like Curtis Mayfield.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't know how to do it, you know, but sure. you guys do. So
yeah. 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 Well, Paul, this has been a great conversation. We could do a number of these. And maybe
sure.
maybe we'll come back, you know, next year and talk about it. But so when is the book going to be out? When's it going to be available?
I think it's going to be I think it's already available in the UK.
Okay.
On Amazon UK. I think it's already for pre-order. I think if people order
great.
It, I think it's going to be there for certainly for Christmas.
Okay, great. And how can people
who wants to receive a book like that for Christmas? Everybody.
Nerds like us.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great, Paul. So how can people get in touch with you? Can you share an email where people can connect with you?
Oh, I'm on Facebook.
Okay.
Paolo Leite, I'm on Facebook. I'm easy to find. I mean, on the book, I'm sure there is my
we'll put a link. We'll put a link in the
put a link. I mean, I love talking to people about horror films. I manage I am the administrator of several Facebook groups about horror films.
Nice. Okay.
And
as we end, what are your top three?
Of horror films?
Yeah. If you had to pick three.
Man, that's like asking a Christian what's your favorite sin. I mean,
I know. It but you gotta. I'm a big fan of forced limitations.
Okay, yeah, very very true. Well, I would say, number one, Rosemary's Baby has the perfect script.
Okay.
An absolutely perfect script. The number two, I would look for The Exorcist. I think is the most fascinating portrait of total desolation. And it's a very complex story, The Exorcist. People usually don't get it
so
right.
So you go for those satanic films.
Yeah, I love it. And on number three, it's my all-time guilty pleasure, which is, I already said it, it's Return of the Living Dead by Dan O'Bannon from 1986, I think. It's a
which is the third
script.
the third zombie. You had Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead.
No, this is not the Romero one.
Romero made
Day of the Dead, I think, in 1985.
Yep.
Which is an incredible film.
Okay.
But I love the Dan O'Bannon one made in 1986. It's Return of the Living Dead. I think it's a beautiful script and fun, and it has a great soundtrack. Great music.
Interesting. All right, my three.
It has a Rocky Erickson, Burn the Flames.
Interesting. Okay. So I would go Night of the Living Dead, American Werewolf in London, and The Omen, I might put in there.
Man, I watched The Omen. I watched The Omen when I was a kid. I think I was something like 7 when I watched it with my older cousins.
Yeah.
I couldn't sleep for a week after I watched The Omen.
I would maybe put the original Amityville Horror in there as well. I don't know. It's tough.
Those are great films, you know. They took risks, and they were incredible.
The scariest thing in the world to me is the soundtrack to Amityville Horror.
Yeah. I think something that is
terrifying.
Not controversial at all. Okay. But some people may find it controversial. You know, I think in horror films, sound is more than I think in any other genre, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think in horror films, sound is so important.
Yeah.
You're talking about
sound design?
Everything. Okay. Let me give an idea. I think there is so much creative work that can be done in horror films regarding licensing of music, of songs, choice of songs. I see many, I understand why. Lots of horror films usually go for heavy metal music.
Right.
And I understand why they do that.
Which I don't love. It's kind of the obvious choice.
Exactly. Many times it's the obvious choice. Many times they think it's the only music they can get, you know. And I think there are so many more interesting options that they should consider when making a horror film. There are so many types of genres of music, types of ages, decades of recording, recordings.
Yeah,
that filmmakers can really, really think and choose.
Mm-hmm.
And I rarely see these on films today. I would love to do more horror films and explore the music licensing.
I think there's
much ground to break.
I mean, we could talk about this forever, but I think part of why that is, and it kind of goes back to the idea of force limitations. If you have to do everything yourself, like John Carpenter's The Original Halloween, it's like, was he the best composer? No. Did he have the biggest palette? No. But what he created, because somebody had to do that, you know, it's like, it's perfect that, okay, we got to do this movie with 8 people and $800,000, whatever the budget was. It's like, you just kind of, you're forced, those limitations force you in new directions. And I don't think you could find a better horror soundtrack than The Original Halloween. You listen to the first five minutes and you're transported there. And that really is the net of great music and films. It's like, does it transport you? Does it let the listener step into the experience of your film? So Paula, this was great, man. Thanks for joining us on this. And maybe we'll come back early next year and talk more about horror films.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, Paula. Pleasure. Thanks so much. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Hey, happy people. Thanks for checking in. My name's John with the Sync Center. And we are deep into a series called the Sync Supervision and Clearance Series, where we talk about questions and best practices for managing music in visual media, whether it's an advertising campaign, a theatrical release, branded content on YouTube, or even a first-time filmmaker in film festivals. Managing music can be tricky, so we like to set aside some time to unpack and talk about a common question really to help you succeed in getting your project out in the world.